guys, this is Austin
and John,
and welcome to another episode of the Meat Gistics podcast.
So this is a special episode. We have somebody joining us. It is a remote guest, something we've done before, not often, but I really wanted to talk to this guy, mostly because about 3 months ago, there was a couple of weeks where I was sure he was Austin. I was 100% convinced because, you just see the little icon when you post things on Meat Gistics.
Yeah.
And I saw your face and your head, and I'm like, okay, well, Austin's doing something. Like, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember thinking, why would Austin post that? And I finally looked and it didn't say Austin. So I immediately clicked his profile and sent him a message. I'm like, hey, don't know if you know this or not, but you look exactly like Austin. So this is Gabriel Hart, G-Chart on Meat Gistics for you Meat Gistics users. We got to talking, and Gabe has a job in an industry that obviously dovetails with what we do. It is the ag industry, and he's got works for a pretty interesting company. So we wanted to have him on and discuss that. Gabe, you want to talk a little bit about precision planting?
Precision's been around since 1993. We're an industry leader in the high tech agriculture, like add-ons for planters and combines. Do a little bit with sprayers as well, but with the goal of teaching and trying to drive the profitability and productivity for farmers.
And that was one of the things when you and I first started talking that made me really interested in your company. That is very similar to what we try to do here. Inform your customers, your potential customers, give them as much information before the purchase and after the purchase. Make sure that they're making the right purchase, and then make sure that they know how to use that to its best ability.
Yep. That's definitely one of the things that obviously drew me to, Walton in the first place, is all the great content you guys put out as far as for learning opportunities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously I would love to take all the credit for that, but it was Austin who saw the need for that and started doing the videos. Then he just dragged me along at some point.
I'm glad I actually got some credit there, because you slammed me real hard right before before we started the podcast. But no, I did kind of start things, but we wouldn't be where we are without what you've done. You've put out so much more content than I could have dreamed of.
Well, so. There was a 2 or 3 years there where that was really all I was responsible for. I mean, I was updating products on the website, but not much, like here and there. So it was really just make a bunch of how-to videos and do this. So I look back at that as almost like the golden age. Like, there was no responsibility. All I was doing was making things. And now, I mean, the job is still obviously amazingly fun, but
you might get back to that a little bit more if we get a couple new people in here.
Yeah, I'm hoping to. Yeah. Very much hoping to. Okay, so there's a couple meat stories. Well, actually, there's a couple stories in general that are in the news that I really want to talk about today. The number one is something that has nothing to do with meat processing, but does have something to do with something that is near and dear to our heart. Gabe, I don't know how you feel about this. Feel free to chime in with anything. We often hear these horror stories of mass shooters with a AR-15 or some sort of rifle like that. What we don't hear is when somebody uses a rifle like that to save lives. In Arkansas, there was a disturbed younger gentleman, he looked to be in about his 20s, who had some sort of psychotic break. He lived in an apartment complex. He was trying to lure people out so that he could shoot them. Unfortunately, he did get to take one life, but a neighbor sprung into action, grabbed his rifle, went out, and ended the threat. This is not getting any play in the mainstream media. It went right under the radar. The only reason I even heard about it was on a different podcast. So I wanted to use our small voice to amplify that message as much as possible. It is incredibly important that we recognize good guy with a gun. Because in my opinion, good guy with a gun is the only way to stop bad guy with a gun.
Yeah. I mean, in that scenario, the only way to stop somebody like that is to have some sort of force that's equal or greater. If you walked in there just saying, hey, would you please stop shooting? They're not going to stop.
No. A social worker.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where, there's a lot more stories out there than what you just see in the news, both good and bad.
Sure.
This one, at least, even though it was kind of a bad and sad story for how it starts, it's at least good that somebody was able to step up and be that local neighborhood hero.
Yep.
And more or less fix things. Yeah. I mean, you don't fix the first life that was lost,
right? But,
you at least prevent others from being taken.
Yep. All right. Yeah. So
obviously any loss of life is bad. I mean, obviously at the end of the day, right, two guys lost their people, lost their lives. But think of how many more lives might have been lost had the gentleman not had his gun there and available.
Yeah, had he not gone in,
yeah,
I think that guy could have gone through, had he wanted to, the entire apartment complex. That is a great point. We've said it before on this when talking about COVID deaths. A single life lost is a tragedy. That's the end of somebody. That's the end of their family. And if I go too much further, Patrick's going to clip this and make another little John on death too. He made this short little video that was just me rambling about death. So you still haven't seen that, have you?
No, I haven't seen that.
Maybe we'll try to interject that into the podcast here because it is actually pretty funny. Patrick compared me to an actor looking for his motivation. Like, and it does, like I'm looking around, I'm like, I don't know. Like, how do I feel about that? Anyways, it is fairly funny. Gabe, are you a gun owner?
I am. Yeah.
Okay. Are you a hunter?
Mostly shotguns. I am a hunter. Yep. I've been raised up as a hunter. I've been hunting since I could walk pretty much. Even if I couldn't tote a gun, running out and, flushing rabbits and stuff like that and running.
So you're born and raised in Iowa?
Illinois. Yep.
Illinois. Okay. So you're from Illinois, not Iowa?
Correct.
Okay. Because when I was looking at precision planting, I kept seeing Illinois and I'm like, they must have multiple plants. Because I, for some reason, was sure you were in Iowa.
When I looked it up, I immediately saw that it was like right next to Pekin. And Pekin is where Excalibur is.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Gabe, do you know, have you ever been to the Excalibur, either their smaller R&D lab or their big production facility?
Yes. So Excalibur is actually how I found you guys, because we used to, growing up, be able to kind of walk up to Excalibur and from their storefront buy what we needed to buy for sausage making, that kind of stuff. And eventually they got, big enough and they, became mostly B2B. And they said, hey, if you want to buy some stuff, check out this Walton's place. And so Excalibur is actually how I found you guys. But I have had the chance to tour their main facility here in Pekin to see how the production, mixing, stuff like that is done. Just see all the racks and racks of delicious spices sitting there.
Yeah, we've got to make it up there at some point.
I have been there before, but it's been 8 to 10 years probably. I know they've done a lot more and added on since I was last there sometime. I don't know, maybe we can make a long trip out of like Minneapolis sometime, go up and catch the Ranchera guys, and then like on the way back or vice versa on the way up, because it's at least north. It'll be out of the way a little bit, but
I've never minded a long drive. I like them. But that's cool. That's like a
come on up.
Yeah. If we come up, we'll absolutely, if we get to Illinois, we will 100% hit you up for that. Now, this is kind of a cool, like all encompassing story. We have our relationship with Excalibur, an individual's relationship with Excalibur that led them to us. And now we have a relationship with that person to the point where they're on our podcast. That's a really cool way of closing that loop. I mean, obviously we love Excalibur because they make really good spices, but we have a nice partnership with them. Like, we primarily try to get people to use their sausage jerky, whatever seasonings, A, because we really like them, but B, because we've done business with them forever. We're comfortable with them.
Yeah, it's definitely a back and forth relationship there. It's not just one company selling to another. We definitely do a lot to help each other out, for sure.
All right, so back to more of the precision planting stuff. I wanted to talk a little bit about seed technology. That seems to be one of the things, as well as all of the add-ons that precision planting is focused on. Gabe, I know it's not necessarily your field, but can you talk about that at all?
A little bit, yeah. So for a number of years, we were actually owned by a large seed company out of St. Louis, whose name I'll not say for lack of... some people have a non-favorable viewpoint of them, so we'll leave that lay. But yeah, definitely seed technology is something that's huge, and something, you know, is continually being studied, continually having that envelope pushed, and whether that's, you know, resistance to pesticides or resistance to pest, period, you know, making it more drought tolerant, you know, having seeds that are better in certain types of soils or crop conditions. Yeah, there's a ton of science being done right there.
Yeah, you said one thing there. You said resistance to pesticides. Are you talking about making them resistant to pests, or are they working on seeds that do a better job at not absorbing the pesticides?
So I misspoke a little bit there. I did mean to say resistance to pests, which is a thing, but there's also herbicide resistance, so that you can, you know, like Roundup Ready, soybeans, Roundup Ready, corn. So that you can spray down a field to help eliminate some of the herb, you know, weeds and stuff like that. But the, you know, plants, corn, soybeans.
One of the things I saw on a lot of the pages was sugar beets. Are there a ton of sugar beet farmers in Illinois? I mean, I just don't think of it as that big of a crop nationwide, at least. Is it really big in Illinois?
It is not big in Illinois at all. There are, as far as I know, no acres pretty much in Illinois of sugar beets. It's very regional. You get, in the United States at least, the biggest areas are Minnesota, North Dakota, pockets of Michigan. Actually, where my wife is from, in mid-Michigan, kind of Bay City area, Saginaw, there's a good pocket of soybean or sugar beets that get planted there.
And then obviously Scranton, Pennsylvania, where Schrute Farms is.
No one's
getting that joke.
You know, I've got a list.
That was a joke about the office, Dwight Schrute. He's a beet farmer. Nah,
no,
that,
I got no idea.
That missed badly. Oh, well, what are you going to do? All right. So one of the things you talked about there was improving yield. Do they do anything with these seeds to also try to improve nutritional quality, quantity? Are they doing anything like that?
Definitely. That's not something I get, as you say, I don't get involved in too much, but there's definitely a lot of science behind that too. And obviously as we're feeding the world, you know, figuring out ways to boost the proper nutrients in a, you know, crop. And then are there obviously things that are outside of the seed, how, you know, how you grow that, that impact the contents of that crop as well. That's something that's really big too, and like sugar beets and how you, you know, grow it and you apply, you know, nutrients to the field really have an impact on like the sugar content of those beets. That's a big thing that they look at for sugar beets.
I mean, that makes sense. I really do feel like at some point in the future, caloric density is going to become very important to people. But right now we have, I mean, in the US, I hate to say it, but we have fat homeless people. Like, calories aren't an issue for us at the moment. Obviously, we have enough to provide for everybody. But as population continues to grow, I really do think there'll be a switch and people will be more cognizant of what they eat, and they'll be looking for foods that are higher in caloric value, because there'll be some form of scarcity. I'm not saying it's going to be the Hunger Games, but there'll be some form of caloric scarcity.
This is just another instance of John taking something and turning it towards like a dark side of some sort.
I can't help it. I can't help it. I really try, but I can't help it. All right. Going on to another dark topic, which hopefully, and I have heard some things about some reversals or at least some plans on what can be done to mitigate it, is monocropping. Is something you see all across the Midwest, in fact, all across the US. And that's where a huge portion of land will be used to grow just one specific crop. My thought process on that is that it's necessary. You need, in our type of economy, you need specialization. You need ways for farmers to be able to be more efficient so that they can produce more food. Monocropping grows out of that, but it definitely has some drawbacks environmentally. Gabe, is there anything that you know of anyone in the industry that's working on to try to mitigate those effects?
Yeah, I mean, as we talk about, you know, certain crops have different ROIs for farmers. You know, certain crops do better in different soils around the United States. And that lends itself more towards, you know, more of that crop getting planted. There is definitely an impact to the soil as far as the nutrients that those crops pull out as they're developing. To make sure we put those nutrients back in, you know, kind of replenish the soil, but also to encourage some sort of rotation. Here in the kind of Corn Belt, I mean, corn and soybeans are our two biggest crops, and it's super common just to rotate corn, soybean. Though you do get some guys who do corn on corn year after year. Got to be careful with that, though.
Is that a good mix, corn then soybeans, switching them back and forth? They take different minerals from the dirt? Oh, okay. Huh, I didn't know that. That's a good thing.
Yeah, in Illinois and Iowa and kind of the I states here, that's pretty much what we have is like an even split of corn and soybean acres, almost 50-50, and then you just rotate year after year which one you put on.
Yeah, one of our...
I was going to say, just in the I states here, it's a pretty much an even split between corn and soybeans. You get guys putting on a little bit like winter wheat, and they'll follow up with a soybean crop. But it is pretty much all of our acres here in the I states are corn, soybean.
So being I wasn't necessarily a city boy, I was a suburbs boy, but from New York, had no idea the amount of things that go into agriculture in general. Like literally, I thought, you know, you sprinkle your seeds and then you come by at the end and pick the corn and do nothing in between then and now. So it is amazing the amount of resources that farmers have at their disposal to be able to maximize the yield from everything. It really is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, there was, I hate to drag politics in all the time, but there was a politician, I don't remember who it was though, like last election cycle, maybe the one before, that was like, oh, you just take a seed, you put it in the ground and plants grow. And it's like, it's easy.
It's Cuomo.
Cuomo, that's yeah. That's right. It's like, dude, no. It is a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, that was very funny. But we did one of our earlier podcasts was on regenerative farming. It's a process that it sounds like people out there at least are somewhat trying to incorporate by, you know, rotating crops. Do you see that as gaining any steam within the industry?
Absolutely. I think it's something that a lot of people are taking a good look at now. Especially as you talk about, you know, the use of pesticides and herbicides and what runoff can do like that, and, you know, soil washing away or blowing away. There's a lot of things that we can do to help replenish the soil and actually take care of our ground that'll, you know, benefit us in the future. You know, we take care of it. It takes care of us. There's a lot of stuff being done as far as like, guys have been doing no-till for a long time. Strip-till has really taken on to help with a lot of the challenges that people see in no-till environments.
So can you talk about that a little bit?
Cover crops. Yeah. So no-till is especially common in putting in a soybean crop after a corn crop. Soybeans are more easy to grow. They're a little bit more resilient as far as their growing conditions than, say, corn is. And so it's pretty common after you harvest corn to leave, you know, about a foot tall stalk left in the field. And then you just leave that field sit with all the residue kind of sitting on top. And then come spring, instead of doing fall tillage and then coming through and finishing the soil up again in the spring, you know, that's two passes that you're doing it on tillage, if not more. And then putting your seed in the ground with a no-till soybean, you would leave all that lay on the ground and then you'd come through and just plant right into it. And soybeans are pretty good about being able to pop up through the residue and put on a good crop from that. Corn is a bit more sensitive and doesn't really lend itself to that kind of environment. It needs some of that residue, you know, pushed aside or mixed in. It needs a good path for sunlight to be able to hit the soil to warm it up, which is something that we, you know, you struggle with no-till, is having that blanket of crop residue from the previous year sitting on top of the soil. You don't actually have sunlight hitting the soil to warm it up, which is very necessary. And so with strip-till, you go through and you actually do tillage, but you only run a strip of, you know, 8-10 inches wide where you're going to be putting your seed, and you incorporate that residue in, get it breaking down, get some of that soil exposed to the sunlight. And so you do have an area where it's tilled that you can plant your seed into, but then you have next to it that 10 inches that's tilled, you have 20 inches where you still have those root formations from the previous year. You still have that residue that's helping trap in some of the moisture. It's keeping the soil from washing away. It's maintaining that kind of environment there.
All right, I've got to ask you, because perhaps my understanding of your position at Precision Planting is incorrect. What is it that you do there?
Technically a sales analyst. I look at all of our sales numbers, more than just sales, but our purchasing team, our warehouse, any of the metrics, graphs, data, or systems, even kind of stuff that needs work. I do all that reporting and analysis.
What you just went over, from my perspective at least, is an incredibly detailed and knowledgeable discussion about no-till. Is that something that you learned just from growing up where you did, or is that from the company?
That's from the company. We do a ton of teaching, and so I'm kind of a sponge. I love to learn all sorts of different kind of things. And so when we do have some of our conferences and stuff that we put on, I love to sit and kind of absorb, you know, what we're learning, what we're trying to teach others, because we're all about learning and then sharing that with other people. You talk about trying to ask a farmer to experiment with a lot of his ground to see what works best. And there will, you know, there are some guys out there who are willing to experiment, but you're talking about their livelihood. If an experiment goes wrong, it, you know, could cost them a pretty penny. So that's where we try to take it on, and we do a lot of studies. And then throughout the year, we'll go to farm shows, we'll host field days. Every winter, we have a big thing we call Winter Conference, where we invite thousands of people out to, you know, come have a free steak dinner and spend all day talking about what's new in agriculture, you know, what processes, what different trials we've run in the past year, what we've kind of learned, and try to help share some of those learnings with other people.
Yeah, that's very, we do something similar. We bring in some commercial customers every couple of years. We try and bring in some ag and meat processing professors in to go over what's new in the industry, what the newest trends are, and just try to give them the same thing, as much knowledge as possible, and try to mitigate, like if they are wanting to try something new, we try to give them all the information so they don't do something and have it not work.
Yeah, a lot of that is networking too for them, just talking to the other guys in the industry, because someone's usually tried whatever's on your mind or what you want to do, and you find out from somebody else, oh yeah, that worked great, or oh no, don't even dare think of trying that.
But yeah, it's the same type of business approach. An informed customer is a happy customer, and a happy customer is a repeat customer. So the better you can do at handing off not just products but knowledge, the better off everybody is.
Yeah. And so we encourage, we work through a dealer network to sell our products. We encourage them to put in plots so that we take not only the learnings of what we're doing here in central Illinois, obviously different parts of the country do things differently. And so we encourage them to put in their own plots. But in addition to that, we have something we call PTI. It's basically a test farm that we have about 400 acres here in central Illinois. We invite people out to come check out the 75 plus plot trials that we're doing so they can actually see hands-on the impacts of the different stuff that we're trying out.
Yeah, that's awesome. Out of all of the things you guys have come up with in you know, the last, you said you've been in business since the 90s?
93. Yep.
What do you think the biggest innovation you guys have come up with is? Tough question.
It is.
And doesn't necessarily have to be about just something that you find interesting. Maybe it's not the biggest innovation, but something that's just really interesting to you.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much the ability to do anything to have any sort of impact on your farming operation, you need to be able to understand what's going on before you can actually make any changes to make things better. And so in order to gain insight onto what's actually happening, kind of the first and foremost thing is to get an idea of what you're currently doing today. And so that's where we come in. We encourage guys to put like our computer screen in their tractor and hook up sensors. Even before you start controlling stuff or trying to improve things, we do what we call shining the flashlight. Keep a pulse on what you're doing. Where are the problems? Like, don't just start spending money to try to fix things where you're not sure where you're gonna get, you know, the bang for your buck. Like, figure out what your problems are, and then, you know, try to attack them. So that's where we try to set people up with, you know, tools to help them identify what their problems are.
And so is that the screen you were talking about, is that the 2020 unit?
Yep.
Okay. So yeah, I looked through, I was doing some product research on your page, and it looked like a lot of your products kind of feed back to that. So that's the sort of the central brain. Is that accurate?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so that's a real-time display of all the information that's going on in the back of your planter as far as, is it, you know, bumpy? Are you losing soil contact? Are you getting the right number of seeds in the ground? Is your fertilizer being applied properly? And so there's things that feed information back, but then also at that same time, you can control what's going on as far as if you do want to put more seeds down, if you want certain rows to stop planting, if you want to do what we call swap on and off so that, you know, if you're driving over an area where you've already planted or already applied fertilizer, you're not over applying because obviously those inputs are extremely costly and you don't want to put on more than you need to.
Yeah. And then, so you've got smart depth. You can set the depth from your cab. You've got flow sense, which you kind of talked about, make sure that the correct amount of fertilizer, whatever you're putting down, is going to each of the little sprayers, not just to the valve. You got yield sense, and then you have something called the ready row unit, which I have to say scares me. And it looks like what's eventually going to come back from the future to try to kill all humans. It is a very aggressive looking machine that those little blade things on it. Oof. Better run from that.
Yeah, looks row vicious. Cleaner or openers. So actually, I mean, that's the basis of what a planter is comprised of. So a typical Midwest planter has about 16 of those, depending on where you're at. Some may have 8 to 12. Larger ones could have 60 of those hanging off the back of it. And traditionally, you'd have all of those, we'll call it 16 of them, hooked up together. Every one of those rows is putting down the same exact amount of seed. They're all putting down seed at the same time. If you've got fertilizer or anything like that on your planter or insecticide, it's all getting put down at the exact same rate. And that's where a lot of our products kind of step in and make every one of those rows of your planter act on its own. Like just because one row is planting doesn't mean all of the rows need to be planting to avoid things like overlaps or if you're doing turns, like if you're going around curves, like, you know, some rows will slow down, some rows will speed up. So that way you have the right number of seeds per like inch of soil as you're going through the field.
Yeah, that's not what I do. Like when I'm seeding or fertilizing my lawn with my little rower, as I turn, I don't account for that at all. So those areas get too much. So yeah, that would make sense. But I thought you just put the seeds in the ground and then you come back later and collect your plants.
Yeah.
All right. So
that's all there is to it, John.
It's that easy. Moving on from precision planting, let's talk a little bit about two things I found out about you that I find very interesting. One is we share a somewhat of a passion, at least for old trucks. You have a 1948 F1.
That's correct.
Talk about that.
Let's see. I got that about 10 years ago. So before kids, I had motorcycles. And when we started having kids, I decided this probably wasn't the best idea because I have a tendency to get stupid sometimes, make poor judgment decisions. And so I wanted something that was going to be a little less fast, a few more wheels. So I ditched that and picked up a 1948 Ford F1. When I picked it up, it ran and drive a little rough though, from a guy here locally. It still has its period correct flathead V8 in it. But it's something I love tinkering with. My dad was an old car guy, and back when he was still around, we used to work on it together and had some really good times doing that. And so I still tinker around a little bit. I'm not a huge mechanic, but I love getting under the hood or doing what I can with it.
Yeah, so it goes beyond just appearance. Austin also used to be a motorcycle guy.
Yeah, and I no longer drive a motorcycle.
Because?
I figured I was going to kill myself on it someday. Either from somebody else doing something stupid or me going, hey, I think I can do this and doing something stupid. I figured it was a matter of time, so I better get rid of it.
That's the thing, is you can be as safe as you want to be, but you can't affect what all is going on around you.
Yeah.
Like there was one night I hit a deer, and like, it wasn't my fault. It wasn't the deer's fault. We were just both in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there is no amount of safety that you're going to be able to do that's going to prevent something like that from being able to happen. Obviously, I was wearing a helmet, I was wearing a jacket, so I walked away from it. But there's just certain things that are beyond your control, especially when you've got two wheels underneath you.
Yeah, and especially, so you hit a deer on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
You're lucky you walked away from that. That must have been...
Oof. Both of you walk away from that? Like, were you injured at all? Was the deer injured at all?
I don't think the deer walked away from it very far. I think the police chased it a little bit, but I don't think it stuck its head in my front wheel. So I don't think it was going to survive too much longer.
Gotcha.
Ambulance showed up. Thankfully, it's a crazy story, but it was about 2 a.m. Almost nobody else on the road. But that moment when the deer ran into me, headlights flashed right before my eyes. It couldn't have been but a foot or two away. Person veered off in the ditch, hopped out of the car, just happened to be a paramedic, pulled me off the side of the road, called the ambulance. Everything was fine though. Ambulance checked me out, cleared me. I was able to load my bike up on a flatbed and walk away.
Cool.
Yeah, I go more for like the old Chevy DW, like that look from 83 to like the mid 90s. I love those trucks. If I could find one with the King cab, 100% would get one. I absolutely love the look of them, but it's just, I can't go in 1948. That's too old. I mean, you've got disc brakes on that. It's got to be a heck of a rough ride.
Yeah, it's all four wheel or drum. It is no power brakes, no power steering. It is, and it's non-synchronized transmission. So it is an experience to drive for sure.
Yeah. So we look at it today and we talk about these, not talk about, but you hear stories about wives who never drove and kind of like, why would you be afraid of that? Driving used to be way more difficult, like way more difficult. We're so spoiled with how easy it is nowadays.
Yeah, like now, like my truck, it will like take you back to the center of the road if you're like too far to like one side or the other. Like you don't have to touch the steering wheel. It knows if a car is in front of you, it can read the lane. You just sit there and it just bounces you back and forth between the lines and keeps you behind the person in front of you.
Your truck is basically a transformer though. That thing is so ridiculously technologically advanced.
Yeah. I'd rather have a smart and techie truck than an older truck. I'm not in the same boat as you guys. I don't care about any of the classic cars near as much.
So right now I drive a 2003 Toyota Tundra, I think. Yeah, 2003. Really not out of any love for that specific car, but it was like, I was telling your father the other day, I got such an awesome deal on it that I just have to keep driving it because I'll feel terrible when I get rid of it. Plus, the cost on trucks right now is absolutely out of control.
Yeah. Cost on everything is out of control.
Fair. That is very fair.
I cruise around my main vehicle's an 03 F-150, and yeah, I'll drive that thing till the wheels fall off. It's got 236,000 miles on it. And, hope I get a few more out.
But that's the right way to go. I mean, you should be driving your car. Some people who get a new car, well, I don't know. I guess everybody likes different things. So I was going to say people who get a new car every couple of years seem ridiculous to me. But I mean, if that's your passion, if that's what you like, whatever, do what you want. All right. Another thing that I found out about you is that you are a flashlight enthusiast, which I did not know was a thing.
It's a strange thing, but yeah, it's a thing.
So there's a website called onelumen.com, and you've got a profile there that I found. So how did that come about? Like, what fascinates you about flashlights?
I've always loved illumination. I don't know what it is, but something about lighting in general, like household lighting, flashlights, it doesn't matter. I just love tinkering with them. I love tinkering with pretty much anything. But a few years back, my mom actually got me a really nice flashlight for my birthday. I'm like, this is great. And then a couple years went by and I saw somebody else. I was like, man, mine's really not as great as I thought it was. And I found a website. They're like, yeah, you can build a flashlight. I'm like, wait, you can build a flashlight? And so if I find that I can build something, make something, obviously getting a sausage, I can make sausage. Perfect. Like, I can make a flashlight? Heck yeah. And so do a ton of research or start, you know, soldering my own circuit boards, customizing this and that, writing firmware for them. I have built Lord knows how many flashlights. And then eventually, you know, companies had started asking if I would like to review their flashlights. And so I started doing that. And then a website, One Lumen, asked me if I wanted to start doing reviews for them. And so, yeah.
So you do a lot on Meetgistics. Your work is obviously time intensive and study intensive. You review flashlights for another website. I'm getting a sense that you don't like a lot of downtime.
What's downtime? I have not heard of this.
So I made the joke the other day that if you and Austin had been born around the same time, I would have really thought that maybe Mrs. Walton didn't make it home with both her babies because there's so many similarities. It is absolutely ridiculous.
I remember another thing I think we saw on Meetgistics once is Austin posted a picture of one of his little guys or his little man in a Meetgistics shirt. I just got one of the toddler Meetgistics shirts for my youngest. Looked fairly similar. He looked about the same age as my youngest son.
Very cool.
Yeah,
I just have dogs. That's not as cool.
We could get Meetgistics shirts for dogs.
They've had Meetgistics shirts on. It's on our social media somewhere. I did a bunch of things with it. I just figured it was too cute to pass up. We had some huge piece of equipment here, and I can't remember what it was, but it was a big box, and I wanted to take it home to see how my dogs would react to it because they freak out at everything. So I cut out a window on it. I tried to lure them in there with sausage to get them to like look out. I finally got them in there real quick, but they tore that box apart.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they went absolutely lunatic on it.
That's proving that dogs are a lot like kids. I mean, you get a kid a box or a toy in a box. They don't care about the toy. It's the box.
Yeah.
So I don't even know if the show is on TV anymore, but there used to be a show called Modern Family, and they're talking about one of their sons, and it's that exact thing that he likes the box better than the toy. So one year they just got him a really nice box, and he just played with the bag the box came in. I thought that was a really, really clever joke.
Oh, gosh.
All right. We are pushing time. Do we want to get into these news stories, or do we want to save these for a future? because some of them are really cool.
We should save the bottom one, the like two bold ones.
Okay.
That does, honestly, we could do a whole episode on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we absolutely could.
The first one, I was looking through news articles and stuff and just ran across this, but I thought it was interesting because we've talked about pork production and what's been up, what's been down, and then specifically the problems that China has had. Was it, I'm gonna say it wrong, not looking at it, but is it the African swine flu?
Yeah.
Okay. African swine flu.
Actually, I think they're, it might be fever.
Fever?
I think they're calling it fever, but yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, like decimated their pork production. But the EU increased their pork exports to China by 26%. And this year, it looks like they're going to be even well above that. It's just interesting to see how things shift across the globe in the whole meat industry. When one thing takes a nosedive, you all of a sudden see this area just massively pick up. And then we'll see what happens. But typically what I've seen through it all is like when it all comes back, it comes back bigger than it was before. Mm-hmm. Meat production continues to climb and climb and climb, and it's going nowhere, which then led to the second article, which we'll have to talk about on next week's podcast.
Okay. That's totally fair. One of the things that always just amazes me about a worldwide economy, there are skateboards that are made out of Canadian hardwood. Those trees are cut down. The lumber is then shipped to China, where they make those boards and then shipped back. That is insane to me. That, like, just that it's cost effective to do that. That seems nuts.
I mean, it'd be less than 10 grand to ship a container over there.
Of trees?
Of trees. It doesn't matter what you're shipping over. I mean, if it's in a container, I mean, it's going to be a container of feathers or a container of trees. It's going to be the same thing, but pay 10 grand to get it over there. Or is it worth 10 grand to invest in the equipment, hire the people, do everything you need here? Or you just ship it over there and have That's them crazy. Do it and ship it back.
That's crazy. Absolutely insane. Gabe, so since you're more tied into the farming community than certainly I am and probably Austin is, one of the things we've been noticing a lot recently is the increase in beef costs. I have a suspicion that it is tied into the increased cost of corn. Do you hear anything about that?
I haven't really heard too much about the increased cost in beef. Here we don't have a whole lot of cattle, at least for meat production. We have some here and there, but not a ton. But that definitely, that trend definitely is going up. And I mean, obviously corn prices are tied into it. I think part of it is what you're hitting on a minute ago there with the, you know, the swine flus and stuff like that that are happening. Countries exporting pigs, hogs, you know, needing to replenish those. And so grain prices are definitely getting driven up by that demand for feeding out more livestock.
But I remember after mad cow disease came in, anytime there was a spike in beef prices, that was front page news. I see nothing. There's no news segments. There's no art. There's very few articles on the recent increases in price, unless you're tied into the industry the way we are. Like, I'm not seeing any major publications talk about the increase in beef. It just confuses me.
The media talks about whatever fits their story and what they want for the moment. Notice.
Yeah.
My,
I was
my
debating
glass.
Whether we wanted to go there or not. Yeah.
Yeah. So partially, yes, for sure. But that, I think, and I'm guilty of it too. I think we sometimes we confuse what we see on the TV with what's written online. Yes, there are tons of trash rags online, but a lot of the online articles are fairly straightforward news that people, you know, that these companies think people will be interested in. Increase in one of the main things Americans eat should be something that everybody's interested in, but I'm not finding them.
I mean, it in my opinion, I don't think it's necessarily a good or bad thing. It just comes down to what's going to get more ratings. I mean, you cover the news that is exciting, has some sort of adrenaline to it. Hearing about prices on beef or corn or whatever go up isn't really exciting. It's almost more depressing.
Yeah, but it's still going to get people to, I would imagine it's still going to get people to click on it. Right? No.
Man. I don't know.
Who knows? Obviously, everybody cares about different things. So, Gabe, is there anything else you want to talk about as far as precision planting?
I would say just, you know, if anybody is curious more about it, obviously make sure to hit our website, precisionplanting.com. If you want to see some of the cool things that we're doing, check out our test farm up in Pontiac, Illinois. We call it PTI, the Precision Technology Institute. We also put out a weekly podcast from there, about a 5-minute episode of different trials that we're running. You can subscribe to that in different podcast apps or through our website, if I may plug that.
Awesome. And we'll go ahead and we'll put a link to Precision Planting in the notes of this podcast. So cool. We'll get that out for you. Gabe, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the time. Conversation we've been talking about having for very, very long time. I think it was last year when we first decided we wanted to have you on as a guest, but just the timing for us here at Walton's for the last 6 months has been nuts.
What have you guys been working on?
Well, the new website is the major thing.
Obviously, we haven't been working on the website much because it's full of bugs.
It was funny. Gabe was on our live stream with us yesterday, and we were giving away some stuff. And he won a small grinder, and he was nice enough to say, "Hey, I've got a bigger grinder than that. Draw somebody else."
We'll have to make it up for him.
We will make that up
for being on the show today.
We absolutely will make that up for him. All right, Gabe, thanks so much. We'll talk to you later, buddy.
Hey, been a pleasure, guys. Thanks.
Thanks so much for watching. Remember to like, comment, subscribe. If you're listening on iTunes, Stitcher, anything like that, please leave a review. It really does help. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for checking out the Meatgistics podcast. To shop everything but the meat, head on over to waltonsinc.com. And to get your meat processing questions answered by experts and enthusiasts alike, head on over to our online community at meatgistics.com. Walton's, everything but the meat.